I'm Ben Wheatley, the director of Free Fire. This is Bums on Seats.
And now, for our more dreadful sacrifice.
Boy, all we gotta do is build an act, make you star. Dumbo the Great!
Zero G, and I feel fine.
Dog to the scum-sucking pig, you sons of a motherless goat.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
I've never been alone with a man before, even with my dress on. With my dress off, it's most unusual.
What is it?
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Hey, what about Major Kong?
Hello, you're listening to Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. Many, many thanks to Ian Daybourne for the past couple of hours of music and conversation. But now it's time for Bums on Seats, your fortnightly dose of dynamic film discourse. My name's Ashley Capaldi, and I'm joined in the studio this afternoon by Dae Moybe.
Hi.
Rosie Applin.
Hello.
And Alistair Ryder.
Hey there.
On today's show, we're looking at the controversial Ghost in the Shell, adapted from the famous Japanese anime and starring Scarlett Johansson as a cyborg searching for her identity. Death is only the beginning in the stylish science fiction of The Discovery, while French drama Raw offers a passage of rites with a macabre twist. Plus, we've not only a review of Free Fire, but we also have an interview with the movie's director, the British filmmaker Ben Wheatley. So, a fair amount to squeeze into the next hour, but we begin on the rooftops of New Tokyo.
You never talk about your past.
I don't remember much. Just fragments.
There was an attack.
You were dying.
We saved you.
And now you save others.
Everything they told you was a lie.
You had a family.
Remember that.
What are you?
What a beauty you are.
What do you want from me?
They did not save your life. They stole it.
Adapted from the hugely influential Japanese manga and anime, new release Ghost in the Shell is the rarest of films, a multi-million action blockbuster based around a female lead. Scarlett Johansson stars as Major, a cyborg soldier in an elite anti-terrorism squad. A human brain encased in cutting-edge robotics, Johansson's super soldier is the next development of humankind, though Major struggles with whether she is a sentient being or mere technology. After a surveillance mission turns into a gunfight, Major uncovers a terror plot by a cybercriminal known as Kusei. Able to access and reprogram robots from a distance, Kusei seems to have a mysterious connection to Major's past. Alistair, it's refreshing and groundbreaking to see a woman heading up a film that cost this much to make. Do you think an Asian lead would have sold it, or did we need the Johansson in there?
Well, I mean, there has been all of this very interesting talk of whitewashing around the film, which is even more interesting when you realise that the original Japanese creators never imagined it to be an Asian character. And my perspective is that if, without the controversy, they just hired an Asian-American lead, the film would still be rubbish. It is... the main problem with Ghost in the Shell isn't the casting. If you take away all that controversy and just view the film for what it is, and also ignore the third act where they try and have the cake and eat it around the whitewashing in the most toe-curlingly embarrassing way imaginable, the problem is the fact that it's over-designed. Like, it looks fake. They've tried to make the anime, you know, flesh it out into real life, but it just makes the anime look even more real, and that's all painted and hand-drawn. And people have been comparing it to Blade Runner and The Fifth Element in terms of its design, but I was more thinking of Back to the Future 2, where Marty McFly gets attacked by the thing of Jaws.
That is a fine sequel, Back to the Future 2.
Oh, no. Back to the Future 2, good film. But in terms of its design, where you've got that Marty McFly being attacked by Jaws and shouting, it still looks fake. That's how I felt like screaming at the screen whenever you've got all these holographic adverts coming from the skyscrapers in Tokyo. It looks for a... It just looks fake.
Okay, you calm down, Alistair. I picked the Blade Runner out and I really liked it. As a Blade Runner fan, I appreciated their attempt to marry up those aesthetics. But Rosie, you're an actual anime fan, so were you as viciously let down by the styling of this?
Well, I wouldn't say I feel as strongly as Alistair does about it. I mean, I actually thought the visuals were probably the best thing about the film. I mean, there's aspects of it that I really enjoyed. We were talking earlier about the geisha bots and how they're actually, you were saying, I think they're all robotics
no
rather
CGI.
Than CGI, which I mean, I thought they were really quite compelling and very interesting visually. I mean, the anime, I rewatched the anime version of this recently, and that still, to me, looks incredibly fresh. And, you know, what they did with the animation on that was actually incredible for 1995. I mean, I wouldn't say that it feels as good as that for me, to be honest, but... I thought the visuals were the best thing about it, and ultimately what was a slightly kind of muddled film, I thought.
Yeah. Did it need to be made? Should we have just been driving people back to the original? Because it's basically Inception light, really.
Well, I can see why it would have been made, and it was originally going to be directed by Steven Spielberg years ago.
That might have helped. Instead, we had Rupert Sanders.
Yeah, the man
of
who directed
Snow White fame.
Yeah.
Like AI though, nightmare.
Yeah. Well, I disagree about AI, for starters. But the thing about Ghost in the Shell was the fact that it was influential. It influenced The Matrix and countless other science fiction films.
Right, the original book. That's the original behind The Matrix, right?
Yeah, and this just feels derivative of all of the films that the original Ghost in the Shell inspired and the things that inspired the original Ghost in the Shell, whereas that was an original work of science fiction. This just feels like everything apart from the original Ghost in the Shell. I was also reminded, and this is a film that I completely forgot existed until this morning when I was trying to think of what it was that reminded me of Ghost in the Shell, was this Bruce Willis action film called Surrogates in about like 2008 or 2009. And it was awful.
Never heard of it.
Oh, it was awful. But this Ghost in the Shell, it seems like that's probably the key influence.
I'm going to go against the crowd. I didn't hate it. I liked it, but I think I hate action films. Number one, I hate superhero films. Okay. I hate anime. So I think I was,
I
was sat down Disney. I sat down expecting to be visually assaulted for 2 hours. I was like, oh God, this is going to be awful. And that first shot where it reminded me of the opening sequence of Westworld and that Netflix show. And the sound was very 2001 Space Odyssey. It reminded me of Sunshine, where another Cillian Murphy film. So I was totally hooked in by that opening sequence. And I think, it's like when you write an essay and you have a really brilliant opening paragraph and you trick the person marking into thinking you're an A student. I think that's what happened.
My issue with the opening sequence is it just reminds me of the opening sequence to Under the Skin, which is a better Scarlett Johansson science fiction film.
And she's full frontal in that, so that's, let's talk about her cat suit, because I was going to let them off, but I wondered, why Scarlett Johansson in this role? Why? And then we got, which is essentially the money shot, which is Scarlett Johansson in something that looks like her naked skin, but isn't her naked skin. So come on, was that needed? But was that close to the original? What's she wearing in the original, Rosie?
I don't think she's as consistently naked in the original, but she is naked.
Surprise.
And the original film poster does have her looking very much like Scarlett Johansson looks in parts of this film. I mean, it's kind of an issue of, I guess, bums on seats.
Ruffle.
You know, but I think they were trying to be loyal in some ways, but I think they overplayed it a bit, to be honest. It did feel a bit, as Toby was saying earlier, male gaze.
It's very male gazey, and poor ScarJo does fall into that trap a lot. Well, she's forced into it. She did a good job here, though. We were talking before we started, even down to her body language. It's her walk is producer Toby's favourite thing about the film, and that's something it's consistent. She keeps up, and she walks that line between human and robot really well. She has those big expressive eyes, which are important later on in the film when she thinks she might have found her family. But it's her walk gives her all her robotic power. So were you able to think about how well Scarlett was doing, or were you just completely blinded by your anger?
I have to say, I'm not completely angry. It's a two-star film for me.
Out of 10?
out of five.
Oh, that's not that bad.
Yeah, it's not that bad, but it's like I never needed to see this.
No.
Professional obligations led me to it.
And, a bit like Bridget Jones's Baby for me. That was a fun weekend.
But yeah, no, Scarlett Johansson, I mean, she's good with what she's given, mm-hmm. But as you're talking about the male gaze, that again makes me think back to Under the Skin or Her, which are two other science fiction yeah. films which more directly dealt with that theme mm-hmm. and did it in a more thoughtful way that also managed to show something about the human condition, which right. Ghost, the original Ghost in the Shell anime, from what I'm aware, also tried to explore the human yeah. condition via AI.
Because they're attempting yeah. that overarching question of what is it that makes us human here, aren't they? Yeah. What's a soul or your ghost, or how important is the body to that? Do we go somewhere else? And do you think it even, does it scratch the surface at all?
Nope. Yeah.
Thanks for that in-depth insight, Rosie.
I mean, I was just thinking about Scarlett Johansson and her kind of roles in these type of films. So I also was thinking about Lucy, the one where yeah. she sort of gains fabulous knowledge.
I liked this better than Lucy, actually.
Well, I mean, I enjoyed Lucy. I thought it was quite interesting. And I think she's kind of becoming quite an interesting actress for these types of roles where mm-hmm. she plays this sort of slightly other kind of character, either through alien or robotics or something mm-hmm. like that. And I think she really did her best with what she was given, to be honest. Mm-hmm. As you were saying, with the whole physicality of it, and kind of, you know, there are moments where she's really sort of portraying both the human and the robotic at the same time. I think yeah. she did that really well. But ultimately, yeah, it wasn't a great film for me, to be honest.
Do you think we used Juliette Binoche enough? Another titan of female acting. She's the bit she's in, she's good. They shoehorn her in as this girl female scientist to try and win the half the audience over, I guess. But she does do a great job of subtly showing how she's tied to Scarlett Johansson's character, this thing that she either created or made better or whatever it is she's doing to or with her. But did we get enough Binoche in this? Is it...
Well, you can never have enough Binoche, really,
can
you?
You can never have enough.
I think it would have been nice to see, have, you know, had her character mm-hmm. appear a bit more throughout the film. I mean, yeah. she did bring something extra to it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Nothing could have saved this for either of you. I'll sit on the fence. It's not that bad, guys. Give it half a go. Not on a sunny day like this.
Yeah.
Yeah. You sound convinced. Anyway, Ghost in the Shell opened last Friday and it's still on at both View and Light cinemas in 2D and 3G. 3D, not 3G, that's the internet. It is a certificate 15. Released last Friday, Free Fire seems a move slightly into the mainstream for its director Ben Wheatley. After the dark comedy of Sightseers and the class warfare of last year's High Rise, there's something straightforward in Free Fire's simple gun-crazy storyline. Set in the late 1970s, Free Fire brings together several characters for a sale of illegal firearms. Wanting to buy the guns are a small group from the IRA, led by Cillian Murphy and Michael Smiley. Offering to sell them the guns are a ragtag bunch of merchants headed by an eccentric Sharlto Copley and a preening Army Hammer. Bringing the two groups together is the mysterious Justine, played by Brie Larson. Before we review Free Fire, we have an interview with Ben Wheatley, conducted by regular Bums on Seats reviewer Ben Challoner last week at the Picture House. Our Ben asked director Ben not only about Free Fire, but also about the mood of his earlier film, A Field in England. And to begin with, director Ben discussed what he and his co-writer Amy Jump consider when they're thinking up a new film script.
I think it's all taste, and it's and then underpinning the films there's often like little rules that we've got, and they're things like, oh, you know, try not to repeat yourself or try not to make stuff that copies other stuff, and that kind of makes it forces you into different spaces. And also we make films that we want to see, and we've seen a lot of movies as well, you know. And you just end up seeing gaps in it and going, oh, why? I like that kind of thing, but I don't seem to see it. Why is that? That's weird. And you just write something then, and then you see, then usually we've got like a lot of different scripts out and about, and it's whether or not they'll get traction, you know, with financing. And then suddenly someone goes, oh, actually, same thing happened with Free Fire, where Free Fire had been written like 3 or 4 years ago, and it was just sitting around, and then suddenly everyone became interested in it, but no one was interested in it before.
What do you say we check out the merch? That's why we're here. Okay, just try not to hit any of the metalwork, because I don't want to get any of those bling burns on my new...
Free Fire, the guns you've used have, you know, real volume. They seem like loud and nasty and in your face. I've got a big feeling it's probably deliberate, but I just wondered, did you have to play around with the audio? Did you, you know, have meetings about how you're going to make these scary again, these guns? Because, we, like I say, we see guns in John Wick, we see guns everywhere all the time.
We wanted to... The sound design is to put you in the middle of the movie to make you feel like you're completely enclosed in it, and we wanted to... You know, there is a problem with the way that guns are treated, that they've become quieter and quieter in cinema, and they're at the point where, you know, certainly on television, is that like a punch is the same loudness as a gunshot, and a gunshot is like, it's so loud it will deafen you, you know, if you're close to it, and it's a physiological thing as much as it is a sound. It goes through you and it pushes through, the sonic thing will go through your intestines and it will give you a headache just being close to it. This downplaying of that, it lessens the kind of realism of it, I think, and I wanted to make it feel dangerous, you know, that it's an industrial space, basically, and a gun is like a kind of industrial tool that for throwing bits of metal through the air at you to kill you, you know, and I wanted to get the audience to feel that through the sound design.
This feels like your most, again, I hate to say it, but like, you know, the most mainstream of your premises. Was that a thought of you going into it? Or, because again, you've had this idea for a long, long time. It just seems that way, maybe, from someone.
Well, they're all meant to be successful. They're all meant to make money, and they're all meant to have as broad an audience as possible, sure. In a way. It's more, it plays out to a kind of... I think it's less punishing than the other films are.
Right.
So some of the other movies are from a position of testing the audience, and you know, they've got, you know, there's elements of them that which are difficult formally and also really aggressive, you know. And this movie meets the audience halfway, and it's fun, and that's the vibe. I mean, Sightseers was fun as well, but this is the first film in a while that I've had where people are just coming away from it from all the, and this is from. Me witnessing this, not just making it up. It's like seeing it with audiences, people just having a good time and being happy.
It's that thing you said about the gunshot, feeling it in your bones. They come out kind of like they've just had it.
Yeah, well, it's more that they've just, you know, it's that they've had a good time and it was fun.
Yeah,
and that's something, you know, Amy and I are trying to make, you know, our end game is to make a movie that's, to make it like a kind of a light, charming romantic comedy. That's what we want to, that's what we want to be. And at the moment we're too dark and we're kind of making stuff that's still kind of, you know, aggressive and uncomfortable. So, but we're trying to get to that.
Have you got that film in you? Do you know what you want to write about that would be light-hearted and...
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's just hard for us, and it's a challenge rather than something it's easy to make.
I read that obviously you built the warehouse at Minecraft at the start, and also I read somewhere there was a vague link of, you know, you thought a lot about Counter-Strike when you were writing the screenplay. Are you a gamer in general?
Yeah, I have been since I was a kid.
Yeah.
So I've played computer games since, you know, ZX Spectrum days. You know, so I've always played computer games, and I find them very therapeutic. And I find them as influential, really, I think, as films in many ways, you know.
Absolutely.
So certainly, I think when you see Free Fire, you'll see, like, if you know Counter-Strike, you'll know like the assault level on Counter-Strike is very similar to some elements in Free Fire.
I hope you don't mind going back to maybe one of your earlier features. With A Field in England specifically, it's probably your most experimental film, both artistically and in the way you distributed it. I just wondered, would you consider doing something like that again? Obviously with the trajectory your career's going in now, with bigger budgets, more opportunities, more options of what you can do, would you maybe do a smaller budget, risky film, you know?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, at the time it was a step backwards from the you know, after doing Sightseers, which was like, £1.2 million, and then go to jump back to £300,000 was, but it had to be because that film was so weird, you know, that you couldn't make it, and you shouldn't make it for more money than that because it's just a waste of money, you know. And if you want to make your crazy film about, you know, your relationship with your dad through the, you know, with a flute kind of soundtrack, and, you know, and your thinking about your own dreams, then you need to, if you desperately need to make that movie, and it might be a great movie, then you should make it, but you shouldn't take a load of people's money and then piss it down the toilet, you know, while you do it, you know.
Whitehead, show yourself!
I am my own master.
Do you think it's harder to get into the film industry at the moment, or is it harder to stay in the film industry once you've put your foot in the door and you're making those films?
Well, I think the thing is, the nub of it is that is the assumption that there's a film industry.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't think there is one.
Right.
I think the reality of it is that there's a lot of cottage industry. There's a lot of little outposts of people making movies. And that you don't get into the industry because there's no industry to get into. What you've got to do is create your own industry around yourself. So, and that's what we did with Rook Films, which is Amy and Andy Stark and my company. You know, we formed a company and then we started production and making movies. So, and I would say, and that's the thing, you know, kind of, I've always had this thing of mantra of going, you know, you've got to make your own stuff and push yourself forward. But then we get loads of emails from people going, can you help us with our scripts? Well, kind of no.
Right.
You know, you got to help yourself and pull yourself up, and then you form your hub, and then you work out from that position.
What makes a film outstanding for you personally as an audience member? You know, are there certain qualities that you look for in a film other than just, you know, maybe narrative structure?
I like to be lost in a film, and then I like to be experience the film has an atmosphere that is completely all encompassing and then carries you through, and you. You are transported somewhere else, and that can be in time as well, you know, and there's nothing but the film, and then it plays you up and down with emotion. You're like going, oh God, I'm afraid, oh I'm happy, oh, and it's like some master in the background playing the keyboard, and by the end of it you're exhausted. And I think that's my favourite kind of cinema, where I'm chasing meaning, I'm overwhelmed by it.
That's the exact feeling I got watching Field in England.
All right. Well, it was meant to be like that, because we wanted to make an historical movie where it was as if you teleported to the past from now, rather than in this kind of expositional world where everything's explained for you. Because, you know, even when you just go abroad and you're in Greece somewhere and there's some kind of festival and they're all carrying something and all they've got, you know, and all singing or something, you go, I don't understand what the context of this is. I've got no idea. But no one's going to tell you what it is.
Yeah.
You know, you might be able to look it up in a guidebook or something, but no one, in a film, someone would turn and go, oh, this is the festival of the law, and it's been happening for 200 years. And you go, oh, right.
But I know exactly what you mean. And there's so many people I know as well, I get like, I didn't like that at the end because it didn't tell you anything. I'm like, that's the point.
Well, yeah, and questions are always more interesting in a way than answers, because you make your own answers up in your head to a degree.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Ben Wheatley for finding the time for the interview, and to Bums on Seats regular Bridget Bradshaw for making sure the recording was crystal clear. Nice muffler, Bridget. Also, many thanks to Zoe Flowers and Jack Toy for arranging it all. Day, this guy is one of your favourite directors, your favourite British director, yes?
Yeah.
You loved Sightseers, as I did, that strange little murderous couple. What were you expecting when you went into this? Were you disappointed? What did you make of it? Such an uber Ben fan.
I actually really enjoyed it. I'm not a big, like, violence kind of girl, and neither am I a big shoot them up kind of girl or Hollywood kind of girl. But this,
great.
This Ben Wheatley was perfect in this. I think it was fun and entertaining, and it just kept you going, kept you laughing. That was the whole point of the film, and I think that's what Ben does really well.
Yeah.
You know, if he's trying to give a new take on violence, then it is. It does that exactly to a, like, bullseye.
Yeah, exactly. And I was at the Q&A, and he was saying how sick he is of Hollywood shootouts and fight scenes. So you've got these people with no gun experience taking clean shots through someone's forehead, and it just doesn't happen like that. And so this is a lot dirtier and true to life, but was it boring? Because in real life, it would take you an hour and a half to shoot a warehouse full of people hiding from you. But were you bored? Were you kept along, Alistair?
I mean, it's not the best film of the year by quite some distance, but it is one of the most fun cinema experiences that you'll have in the year. And I was lucky to see it at the Picture House preview with Ben Wheatley's Q&A. And humble brag, I also interviewed him beforehand for somewhere else.
Nice.
So I'll
humble
just
brag.
Seek that in.
You're a celebrity.
Yeah, exactly. It's great. I can dine out on it. But whilst you're watching the film, it is incredibly entertaining. It's packed with one-liners. It's packed with these utterly hideous characters whose company you just enjoy because of how funny they are. And it's great stripped-down filmmaking. It does exactly what it says on the tin, and it's great. The only issue is the fact that it doesn't really live long in the memory after watching it. Like, I'm struggling to remember bits from it now, and it's been about a week and a half since I've seen it. But I know for a fact that the experience, I just couldn't beat it.
Okay, excellent. We have, you mentioned the sort of ragtag casting there. I loved every single character in this. We'll talk about them all eventually, but Brie Larson's coming under fire, pun intended. I should do this for a living. For being a little wooden, sort of kind of dead behind the eyes, not really developed, and not a brilliant heroine, seeing as she's our only girl in the entire film. Is she letting the side down, Rosie?
Yeah, you mentioned that. I hadn't actually heard about this commentary on Brie Larson, but I have to say I didn't have any problem with her. I mean, I felt that, for me, none of the characters were developed enough for me to really actively care about whether or not they were going to get shot. But I guess that wasn't really the point. The point is cracking dialogue, good fun, you know, what's going to happen. But no, I thought she sort of handled it well. She held her own. I think she was particularly good on the kind of physicality, the sort of slapstick, and, you know, there's a lot of kind of rolling around on the floor and kind of having to sew up your own wounds and that kind of thing. And yeah, I thought she handled that pretty well. I mean, she was quite enigmatic. I definitely wouldn't describe her as wooden. I mean, I think the cast was brilliant. My kind of issue with it, I guess, would be just the sort of, the lack of backstory to the characters. But I think in that respect, it's a little bit like a sort of Tarantino film. You kind of get presented with these sort of archetypes. Here's this funny guy, here's this sort of slightly skanky guy, and you know, it's more about the moment. It's not about, you know, where's this going, what does it mean.
It definitely felt purposeful that we didn't get to know anyone very well, but I would have loved to, because all those guys are hilarious. And again, in the Q&A, Wheatley was describing the naturally chaotic process of who's going to end up in the film. You never know, this person's in, that person's out, that person went well with this person. Serendipity totally took over here. So we got Armie Hammer effortlessly bouncing off that Sharlto Copley I hadn't heard of before, who's my new favourite person in the entire world. But yeah, I would have loved to learn more about them. I think the only sort of relationship we saw was with Brie Larson, who ends up being maybe a little closer to one of the gangsters than you might have originally thought, but we can't give any of that away. But so let's talk characters. Who are your favourites? I'm gunning for the South African played by Sharlto Copley here.
He is fantastic.
Very Partridge, like you said, Rosie. He's Alan all over.
I thought he was absolutely hilarious. I was really happy to see Jack Rayner, who's an actor that's recently been in Sing Street, and I'm just struggling to remember the name of his
character. He's a lovely older brother.
Harry.
Got it.
And yeah, he was really good. I think I could see him becoming quite a big actor. I think he's got something quite special, actually.
Yeah.
I like him a lot.
And Wheatley loves Michael Smiley, doesn't he? Loves him a good Irishman. He puts him in every film. Who did you like?
Steve-O was hilarious for me.
Like Steve-O. Sam Riley.
Yeah. he stole the scenes with just, let's just do heroin. Why not? Let's do it in a shootout.
That's a really good idea. We're not glamorising drug use at all, but he wanted to be taken away from the situation. And that's how he switches off.
Yeah, he was the first one.
I would have put myself down for a nap to get away from it. And that's what Steve-O does.
Just have a little sleep.
Just turn away from the
when
world.
When you wake up. You'll be fine.
Everyone's dead. Alistair, who did you like?
And again, I have to go for Steve-O, played by mm-hmm. Sam Riley.
Nice.
It has been quite a while since I've seen Sam Riley being memorable in anything. I mean, the last film I can remember was probably Control, where he played Ian Curtis from Joy Division.
He's a great character actor,
and that
isn't
was
he?
10 years ago. And this is the first time that he's really leapt off the screen and stood out for me since mm-hmm. then. And of course, Sharlto Copley just chews the scenery.
Get that this, man an Oscar.
This cluelessly sexist man.
Yeah.
Of course, Michael Smiley can just recite Ben Wheatley's dialogue in his mm-hmm. sleep by this point. Mm-hmm, so, yeah, it's incredibly fun.
Armie Hammer actually really worked for me, and I was surprised to see him in this, but he was being sent up, Armie Hammer playing Armie Hammer, basically. But it really worked, and even though we don't get to meet the characters very much, like you said, it's the Wheatley dialogue. They only get a little, but they've got a lot to work with, don't they? Mm. You loved it. You can't remember any of it, Alistair, can you? You just remember the...
Well, I think it's time to move on to the next person.
I really enjoyed Armie Hammer. There's a scene where he tries to light a cigarette at one point and some sort of fire, like water happens. I'm trying to think what the phrase is.
Like when a fire starts in
a
building.
That's it.
Turns water on to try
and
turn
like,
it off.
It's just like, just a little kind of his facial expression in that scene is just hilarious. He was quite a sort of revelation and sort of comedically, I thought.
Yeah, maybe like we force ScarJo into catch suits, we force Armie Hammer into the female gaze roles. We don't give him enough credit, I don't think.
Sure.
No. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Sorry, go Day.
No, I thought the soundtrack was really amazing. I don't think we've talked about the soundtrack, but the soundtrack and like Martin Scorsese is an executive producer on this, yeah. So Wheatley's getting big.
What is that song? The hilarious song, John Denver.
It's You Fill Up My Senses. I meant to mention that. I absolutely love the use of that as the kind of juxtaposition with that and just the
place
nonsense
erupted
that's going on in the room.
When there's a slow-moving truck carrying guns smuggled over for the IRA and John Denver
just crooning. It's fantastic. That is a genius bit.
Yeah,
of,
no, the entire sold-out screen at the Picture House erupted in that. Was there anything that you took away from it, or like Alistair, it doesn't stick in your memory, you just had a great time watching it?
You just have a great time. It's not thought-provoking. You know? You're not going to think about these characters, but you all laugh with these characters.
I think never going to put down anything Wheatley does.
No,
anyway.
I won't. I will support him all the way.
He's a cool guy. He was funny on that Q&A.
Yeah. He was great in the interview I did as well.
check out his Facebook, Alistair. I'm sure he'll post it all over it. Be his friend. Anyway, Free Fire, it's still showing at the Arts Picture House, and it's a certificate 15.
I'm Mandy Morton. And I'm Nicola Robson. And collectively we present The Eclectic Light Show, a monthly arts magazine featuring the very best in theatre, music, film, books and celebrity interviews. Join us on the first Sunday of every month from 2 till 4 on community radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Our next new film release, The Discovery, isn't actually available to see at the cinema. The film premiered at the Sundance Film Festival only 2 months ago, where it became one of an increasing number of new movies bought for distribution not by a big studio, but by Netflix. So, whilst The Discovery misses out on a big screen release, Netflix instead provides distribution to its audience of roughly 80 million global subscribers. It's a brave new world. Co-written and directed by Charlie McDowell, The Discovery stars Robert Redford as Thomas Harbour, a scientist who invents a machine that proves there is life after death. His announcement triggers wave after wave of suicide as people head to what they believe is a better world. As humanity rushes to oblivion, Harbour is visited by his son Will, played by Jason Segel. Will finds his father still experimenting with his invention, using it to send himself to the brink of death before his assistants drag him back.
Dr. Harbour, why did it take you 6 months to address us? Where have you been?
It seems to me that I invite you here to my home.
We only received that invitation after the suicide toll had rapidly reached 1 million. Don't you think your discovery was just too dangerous to share with the world.
Isla! Isla!
How can you keep a discovery so vital to our existence a secret?
You proved the existence of an afterlife. Feel responsible for all those people killing themselves?
We opened the door for these people. Now we have to show them what's behind it.
Okay, we have Rosie and Alistair against each other again on this one. Guess who hated it? Rosie, you came away sort of happily surprised in this one. It's well-trodden ground, though. Is it not just Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Mark II?
Well, yes, actually. I'm sorry to say. I just think it was a little bit. I mean, I think it's conceptually a very interesting film. But unfortunately for me, something did fall slightly flat in the execution. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason why I had that issue is that I'd seen other films like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which I think it does borrow heavily from, both sort of stylistically and sort of thematically. Mm-hmm. But also recently watched The OA on Netflix. Mm-hmm. I know it's not a film, but I've got to say it's absolutely incredible. And so much of that, if you've seen The OA, this will just be totally spoiled for you because it handles a lot of the same themes, but in a much more interesting, kind of fascinating, magical way.
Yeah, whereas, I saw a lot of Eternal Sunshine as well in this, but it lacked the whimsy entirely.
Yes,
because
absolutely.
It's a ridiculous notion, but Eternal Sunshine handled it with humour and sort of warmth and grace, and this one takes it quite seriously.
I think you're right. I think that is a big part of the problem with it. It does take itself very seriously, and mm-hmm. in doing that it becomes very sort of drab and mm-hmm. quite, I mean, just in like how, in terms of the kind of visuals, it's very grey, and there's also a lot of this kind of teal and orange saturation going mm-hmm. on that was quite popular about 10 years ago, and I'm not sure why it's suddenly been decided to be brought back.
It's kind of a throwback, never heard anyone.
Bit of a throwback. But yeah, I mean, you know, I kind of wanted to like it because the cast is interesting. I thought Jason Segel was an interesting piece of casting mm-hmm. in this kind of role, because you don't tend to see him in this kind of role, but... And he was kind of playing this sort of, you know, befuddled everyman character trying to understand what's going on. I felt like I saw him do the same expression about 10,000 times, and it just got a bit repetitive.
He's given a relatively meaty twist at the end as well, and he seemed completely unaffected by it. There was this is a huge revelation. Well, it's meaty by in terms of a fairly dull film, so I think the audience pretty much knew something like that was going to happen, but Siegel's character just he should have been apoplectic at that point.
Yeah, it was quite I don't want to say it, a bit of a one-note performance, I felt, but maybe that was what the intention was. I'm not sure. Rooney Mara does lift it a lot, I have to say. So
she doesn't do much wrong ever, does she?
No, she plays the romantic interest, and you know her role is quite key to the whole story as well. But she does lift it, and she's got that kind of otherworldly magical quality, which kind of takes it a bit more where it needs to go. Mm-hmm. I also found Robert Redford's performance a bit
disappointing. I was just about to ask you, Redford doesn't work either,
no.
I don't think. I think that's where I saw most of the overly seriousness coming from. Like, Redford, your days are over. Like, this should be a funny little whimsical look into the afterlife, and you're not a cowboy anymore. Alistair, anything positive to say?
Well, I can see exactly why Netflix snapped this up, because this film works best when you have another tab open whilst it's playing, so you can do something else whilst it's on. I mean, The Discovery isn't a bad film. It's just, it could be so much more with the concept. It, you know, there's this quasi-dystopian world that it portrays, and there's so many stories that could be explored in this setting, and instead we're focusing on one sort of cult. I'm not going to say cult, but it also feels very strange for it to be a cult when it's also universally accepted that what they believe in is scientific truth. So again, that sort of concept and that the way the story's written just didn't ring true for me.
Yeah, and that they sort of try and introduce a different motivation for Redford's character towards the end, and that sort of seems slung in there at the end to try and humanise him a little bit, and that there is a lot more they could do with the memories, because it's a really nice way that the afterlife is visualised on that sort of grainy little TV screen, and we only get that a couple of times for maybe 30 seconds or so. And so yeah, I do agree, there was lots of potential. This guy, the director, did really well before, though. He did The One I Love. Yeah, I Love That, You Love That. Have you seen that, Alistair?
I Love The One I Love.
Yeah. It's still sitting on Netflix, so check that one out. Maybe skip this one. But yeah, the One I Love was exactly what I thought he was going for with this. Can you see? He was trying to pitch the tone in the same way, really.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if The One I Love, because it's more like a kind of... it's more specific to... It's very kind of one, you know, it's about one couple. This situation is happening with them without giving too much away. Mm-hmm. Whereas he's dealing here with very big themes, and maybe it was just he bit off a bit more than he could chew. Mm-hmm. The other thing I really liked about The One I Love is the humour in it. It's really funny, and I would have liked a bit more of that in this. I mean, yeah. I know it's difficult because it's not really the right subject matter, maybe, but you could have had a bit more.
It definitely could have been, especially with Siegel in your lead role.
Yeah, I would have
people
liked
that. Like Will Ferrell carry straight roles perfectly, and you still get a little Ferrell in there, and he treads that line perfectly, doesn't he?
But yeah.
So yeah, not nice try, but not as good as The One I Love. Back to the drawing board for this one. I think we all have so much more to say on Raw.
Yeah.
So let's get to that as soon as possible. But as I mentioned earlier, The Discovery isn't screening at any cinema. It's available to watch right now on Netflix. And this is the sort of thing you'll hear a lot more of on Bums on Seats. It's becoming an increasingly prevalent method of releasing films. Netflix has actually already paid for the rights to Martin Scorsese's next movie. Okay, and now the feature film debut of writer-director Julia Ducournau. Raw is a coming-of-age drama with a ferocious taste for blood. Set in a veterinarian college in Belgium, Raw stars Garance Marlele as Justine, a new student with high hopes and strong ideals. But the constant lectures on deceased and dissected animals begin to wear Justine down. Then there's the usual trials of new school with hazing, bullying, distractions of the opposite sex. But matters take a still darker turn when Justine abandons her lifelong vegetarianism and develops an appetite for human flesh. Okay, this is one of those weird, brilliant films that we can't box into one single genre. It's obviously the coming-of-age film. We have a little zombie action in there as well, and I found it a proper horror. So what did you make of it, Day, genre-wise, to get serious for 1 second?
I thought it was beautiful. It was compelling and chilling, and it was seductively erotic. And disturbing
explicitly
at the same
erotic
time.
In places,
and
yeah.
She, for a debut film, this just shows so much potential. And you're dealing with this female perspective, and I feel like it's great that it was in a female director's hands, because you didn't get this male gaze or over sexualized or any of the metaphors being overplayed or the symbolism. Mm-hmm. It was subtle, and it really hit a nerve. And there was only 3 people in the screen and I was in, and we were all just like kind of shaking. You can't look away, but you want to just stay fixed on these bold colours, which is reminiscent of like Italian cinema. It's just really fantastic, a really fantastic
She
film.
Knows what she's doing, this newbie. I was in a screening with Rosie, actually, maybe 8 of us all together, but I've never heard more noise being made, especially in a Cambridge cinema. But there's, because, well, you hate horror to start with and blood, so that was a no-go. But I like slasher films. I'm not easily scared, and this horrified me in so many places. I was worse than you.
Yeah, you had to leave at one point.
I had a little break. I had to have a little break. It was literally too much. It's too much.
I mean, I thought it was just incredible, actually. As you said, this isn't the kind of film I would normally go and see, just because I'd be quite put off by the gore. But it's about so much more than that. And I just think it makes some really, really interesting comments on kind of the physicality of humans and our connection with animals and our animalistic selves. I thought it was really incredibly well done. It was very disturbing, visually, you know, very kind of quite difficult to watch at times. And even the sound effects, some of the sounds
the
are really...
sound, proper horror, wow. Horror movie sound. That, those horrible, distressed, high-pitched strings. I hate that so much. Yeah. That was the scariest thing for me.
But I thought the performance from Garance Marillier, it was absolutely incredible. She really captured that sort of transition from being a young, innocent, you know, quite sort of closed off. You know, her parents have raised her as vegetarian. She's off to university. And then that transition where she just gets thrown into this bizarre hedonistic world of
she comes alive
school.
In it, doesn't she? And she's
totally,
loving it.
Yeah, and, you know, she's got really kind of feralistic quality about her at some point, which was perfect for the content. I thought she was just incredible, actually.
You do see her eyes go black, and then you're thinking, okay, it's about to go off. I saw a little zombie in this, which I enjoyed because it was done, I wouldn't say subtly, but it was done well. It is a nod to the genre, I think, and they are in a way turning into something different. That brilliant scene where they're all sort of crawling like insects with their heads down really deliberately, and then they get chucked into this debaucherous rave and all hell breaks loose. What did you make of this as a boy, Alistair, to be
well, I think
basic.
It's the best film I've seen so far this year.
Correct.
I completely, completely love this. Mm-hmm. It's great to see a horror film from a completely new voice, and who's also got a complete awareness for horror tropes. I mean, the story that we're telling, I mean, it's not too dissimilar from Carrie or many other films in different genres, but it's just the first time it's been dealt with using cannibalism. And I think the way it works so well is because you can take it at face value as a horror, or you can just see everything as an allegory for the typical coming-of-age story and family feuds and trying to fit in. And, yeah, I was just completely knocked out by it. And the final scene just made everybody in the cinema sit there in silence for about a minute afterwards. It is completely
what did we just witness?
Exactly. There's,
and no one's getting off lightly in this. No matter what you find sickening or scary, there's something in here to upset you. If you don't like sunburn, steer clear. Watching it as a veggie myself, actually, I didn't find this is going to sound weird. Stick with me for the whole thing. I didn't find the cannibalism the worst thing. That didn't upset me that much. It's no more weird than the concept of putting a bolt through a cow's head, hacking it up and putting that in your mouth. That's weird to me. So the cannibalism, I didn't mind. It was a really odd choice of ways to shock you. So there is an horrendous bikini waxing scene. There's also the use of animals are in it throughout. It's the way we see animals, and even though it's very sort of that they're in a hospital setting, that these animals are being treated well, they're being operated on, they're being made better, but it was horrific to see them in some of the stances that we did. What did you think about it from that end, Day?
I think that was, as a veggie myself, the cannibalism wasn't the horror for me. It was this like it was the primality, that it was so primal in some of the scenes, especially with the horse. And when you're watching
the
how they interact,
this
is why I thought of the human condition and the intense notions of the dual self, for she is changing and this is the coming of age notion, but also how we react and we respond to one another. So I thought that was more scary in itself, because the film has this cannibal scene even when she's like first really going for it. It's this like shame, but then
I like it.
She's playing with your emotions and such on such a thin thread. It's like you don't know, you can't relax. You're just like, I want to stay looking at, but I want to turn my head, and it's, you're so confused, but you're compelled, and it's it was just fun.
And I really like the duality of that, because the way I saw it, she's seeing her meat eating as a lifelong vegetarian as the same sort of shameful rite of passage as developing her own sexuality. So, and those two things happen very close together throughout the film, and she has some erotic pleasure in her meat eating, and it's an odd concept for me to get round. What was the worst bit for all of you, without any spoilers, just kind of try and mime it verbally?
Well, it's like It's like body horror and like David Cronenberg films, mm-hmm. in the fact that the most mundane things are often mm-hmm. the most disturbing, like when she's in bed and just scratching herself.
That
was one of the most terrifying things I've seen. And then going to the fridge and eating just some pork. That was also just raw pork.
Oh, I closed my eyes for that bit. That looked like raw salmon to me.
I thought it was chicken.
Well, I'm also a vegetarian, so I'm not good with my meat.
And Rosie's sort of, she might come over to the dark side. I keep trying to get you over, don't I? So we're maybe not the core demographic.
It's a good film to watch if you are considering becoming a vegetarian, definitely.
It will tip you over the edge. The eyeball thing was the worst for me.
The licking.
Yeah.
I really liked that. Like, I think that sound like a creep.
You really liked that. That's when I decided to take my bar break. I was like, okay, enough. Enough for now.
For me, it was the finger eating, because I think that was one of the first moments of cannibalism.
Yeah.
And it was just, I mean, she's just a brilliant actress. The way she approached it, the sort of sniffing, and it was all very much like an animal. And
she's very animalistic. I love the bit where she wears high heels for the first time, and she's tottering along like a calf, and she's shot from the back, and she's completely uncomfortable in it. There's a really nice, as well, as it's a rite of passage film, talks a lot about families and relationships. That sister relationship is great in this, and it's not overplayed at all, maybe because it is written by a woman who possibly has sisters herself, but sort of the secrecy and the tribalism, and it's really subtly done, isn't
and
it?
And a rivalry at times, you know, and they're both interested in the same guy. And
And it's the tiniest bits of writing that you don't quite understand until maybe the end. You look back and think, oh, that's what that was about. But that, like you said, the rivalry, it was an odd relationship for me at times. I didn't like the big sister at all, I don't think. Maybe because we loved our lead girl so much.
She was an interesting character. I mean, I think it's interesting to see these kind of female characters on screen. She was very she was more like just to go back to the kind of animal metaphor, more like a kind of older, more mature animal who's kind of leading the pack, and she's just focused on what she wants and survival, and she sort of passes on some skills, which I won't go into. I'm thinking of the rooftop scene. I think they're on a rooftop.
Oh, that was really bad.
Amazing. Like,
does that actually work in real life?
I wanted to, like, we should, it makes me curious.
We'll go try.
We should go and try.
Not you, Alistair.
I was like, oh, that's a technique.
Which... I'm not great at physics, but I'm saying no. My money's on no.
Seems unlikely.
I think it's possible. I don't think that it's a lie. I think if some training, you know.
Okay. Moving on. I also saw parallels. Let's get serious. So if some kids who are brought up in maybe strict Catholic households and how that manifests itself when they finally leave and get their own lives, because I saw a lot of her behaviour. There were parallels with possession and exorcism. So there was a lot of sort of religious undertones in that. And maybe that's maybe another angle I think the director's chucking in there, because she's got so much going on here already.
I mean, that's the best thing about Raw, is the fact that it can be read in so many different ways. Mm. And the fact that the film is being sold as, oh, it's this kooky vegetarian cannibalism film. Mm-hmm. But it is so much more. It's a coming-of-age film that can, you know, be... Really, because it's so out there as a concept, you can read into it, you know, whatever. And I didn't even think of the religion thing. Mm. And now you're making me think, hang on, I've got to go back and rewatch it.
I was about to say, there's lots, you've noticed things that I didn't notice, so I want to go see it again. And there's humour in this as well. So our previous director could take a lesson or two. She manages to make eating people's fingers funny and also horrific at the same time. That there were moments when the whole audience just sort of horror laughed at what we were looking at.
It is the shock, I think, and it's the way she presents it. I think, I mean, because we've talked quite a bit about the male gaze concept on today's programme, and I think one of the things that she does amazingly is, you know, she'll portray scenes in just such a kind of naturalistic way. Nothing is at all voyeuristic. So the scene when, so after she eats her first piece of meat and she starts to get this terrible allergic reaction, as you mentioned, she's scratching. And it's very... And kind of the scene where she's in bed doing that, it felt so real. It felt like you could, it wasn't at all voyeuristic in the in a way that other directors could have made it, because it's kind of all shot inside the sheet. And I thought that was, the whole thing was just really kind of cleverly done in terms of how kind of animals and humans are portrayed.
But yeah, it is all in the shooting, because like I was saying, that the bit that was most distressing for me was the way the animals were put up on screen, how their bodies moved, what their eyes looks like. That was the saddest thing. But she does treat her human characters really kindly. She loves this girl, obviously, all, faults and all. And as if she couldn't squeeze any more into this brilliant film, we get great twists at the end. A brilliant twist, and then it's further explained, and that final scene back at home.
Yeah. And it's a nod in the beginning when you see, no spoilers, but then the director's very smart with everything that she's doing in the film, because in the twist at the end, it was told at the beginning. So you're just like, wow, okay.
We come back to the same dining table. Yeah. And it's, and I thought there was something weird in the mum. I'm a great judge of character. I wasn't sure about her from the start at all. But it's, we should maybe mention there's a lot of, not to cheapen it, there's a lot of blood, there's a lot of gore, there's a lot of grossness, but if Rosie made it through, you'll all be fine, I think.
Thank you for recognising that,
you were really brave. Medal, 10
points. I stayed in the cinema all the way through.
Yeah, oh yeah, actually it was me that had to leave. You're right. But no, definitely a favourite of mine this year, I think. Yeah. Anything else beating it for you guys so far?
I really enjoyed, and I'm not really, horror is not really my thing, but mm-hmm. Eyes of My Mother I saw recently as mm-hmm. well, which is also a really good take on horror mm-hmm. because it's kind of asking ourselves now, is what's scary in 2017?
Right.
So you have this dual nature, which we're all facing within ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then in the Eyes of My Mother, it's also the perspective of being alone, you know, mm-hmm. which is, I think, the relationship which comes within the sisters mm-hmm. is now just join me here. I think the sister gets quite frustrated. So I can see where you dislike her when you mm-hmm. like the protagonist, but it's mm-hmm. just stop fighting it. Stop fighting yourself.
And so that's what we get to at the end of War, isn't
yeah.
it? Stop fighting yourself. It really reminded me of Green Room, which I think is still on Netflix, actually. That rewrote the horror genre for me too, which I love. What are we scared of in 2017, and it's, that has some great themes. We have to stop, sorry. Raw opened at the Arts Picture House this Friday. It's Certificate 18, don't miss it.
1, 2, 3, ho!
And that's all we have time for on the show today. And as always, the kit and caboodle will be repeated this coming Monday at 11 p.m. Don't forget our podcast. That'll be available to stream, download or subscribe to via either iTunes or our page on the Cambridge 105 website. And you can keep track of the show when we're not on the air by following us on either Twitter or Facebook. Just search for Bums on Seats. We'll have a brand new show in a fortnight's time on April 22nd. Up for review should be the start of the summer silly season, so we've got Fast and the Furious 8. This time with Charlize Theron and Helen Mirren. Helen Mirren is in Fast and the Furious 8 by request, allegedly. the director of the popular art house drama The Lunchbox, that's fantastic, check that out on DVD, returns with A Sense of an Ending. And at last, with the release of The Handmaiden, the erotic period drama from Korean director Park Chan-wook. Please stay tuned for Bookmark, but from everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye and so long. Yeah.